Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. Today, we're going to be talking about what to expect from your first fertility clinic visit. If you're new to infertility, or even quite frankly, if you're a seasoned veteran, you'll really enjoy this show. Here's a sample of what you'll hear.
No question is silly. It's they should know the success rates of everything, you know, that they're getting into, what's involved, what the time commitment is, and again, what the risks and benefits of each option are.
I'm Dawn Davenport. I'm the director of Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility and Adoption Education and Support Nonprofit. You can find us at our website, which is our online home at creatingafamily.org. This is a weekly radio show, and we use the podcast model. That way you can listen whenever and wherever you want. It also allows you to subscribe, and I really strongly encourage that you do just that. The easiest way is probably just to go, well, if you're on iTunes, just subscribe there, or whatever the app you're using to listen to this, you can subscribe there. Or you can go to the radio page of our website, creatingafamily.org/radio show, and subscribe there. The Creating a Family radio show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. It is that time of year again. It's time to get out your cameras and create a video for the Ferring Pharmaceutical Heart-to-Heart Video Contest. If you've achieved your dream of having a baby with the help of a fertility med by Ferring, you can submit a video. And the theme or the goal here is to give hope to others who are earlier in the process than you are. The grand prize winner will receive a $10,000 educational fund, and there will also be four runners-up, and they will receive a $4,000 educational fund. Now, here's the important part. The deadline is August 31st. The second most important part is to get more information. You could go to their website, which is hearttoheartcontest.com. That's H-E-A-R-T, hearttoheartcontest.com. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not and would not happen without the generous support from our gold sponsors who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support to those struggling to create a family. Some of our wonderful gold sponsors include Reproductive Medicine Associates of New Jersey. They are a recognized scientific and patient care leader in the field of infertility, and they have 21 physicians and 10 offices throughout New Jersey, and they maintain an IVF delivery rate well above the national average. We also have Fairfax Cryobank. Fairfax has been a leader in sperm donation for over 25 years, and they are dedicated to supplying updated, verified, and accurate medical and personal information on their donors. We also have, those are our goals, so some of our gold sponsors, but we also have other sponsors whose generosity allows us to bring you this show. And we ask that when choosing an adoption or an infertility service provider, please consider choosing one from the Creating a Family directories, which you can find on the service provider page of our site. You can search by location, services provided, number of years in operation, number of cycles, just a whole host of factors that we think are important when choosing. And by using these directories, you support those who support us, and we thank you. You know, the world of infertility is confusing, and today we're going to be talking about what to expect from your first visit to a fertility clinic. It helps to be prepared, and this show will prepare you. Our guest today to talk about this is Dr. Beth McAvey. She is a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist with RMA New York, which is the fertility practice of Mount Sinai Hospital. She is also a assistant professor at the Icahn School of Medicine at at Mount Sinai. Welcome to Creating a Family, Dr. McAvee.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me today. A pleasure.
Well, we're going to start with the most basic question that was sent in. And quite frankly, if it hadn't been sent in, I probably would not have thought to ask it. How long does an initial appointment take? That's what Ruth wants to know.
So actually, our practice is a very efficient practice. We have offices throughout New York, several offices in New York City in Manhattan, three, in fact, one on the west side, one on the east side, and one in downtown Manhattan. We also have a Westchester practice. We have a Long Island practice, which is in Garden City, and we have a downtown Brooklyn practice. So RMA of New York really services patients in a very efficient manner. And honestly, patients can be seen within the week.
But how, when you go, I think if I understood her correctly, and I might actually have not understood her question, but if I did understand it, from the time you show up, should you allow 2 hours?
Is it particularly? I'm sorry. Okay.
Well, I may have misunderstood her question as well, but that's how I read it.
I understand. So the initial consultation, I personally, and most of the physicians in the practice, allot 1 hour time frame. I would say to be prepared, maybe give it an hour and a half. Because yes. Following the office visit, we do blood work as well on the patient. And so typically, I would say an hour and a half would be a nice time frame.
Yeah, that makes sense. What should you bring with you on your first appointment?
So most of our patients are referred from their general gynecologist or their general OB, obstetrician gynecologist. And so if they have had any routine testing done, including routine health maintenance, such as pap smear, mammogram, I always encourage patients to bring that. Taking it a step further, if they've had any sort of infertility evaluation, blood work, genetic testing that was done, to also bring that. Some patients come from a urologist referral, and if they do have a male partner and he has had an urology evaluation, any records from that office would also be helpful.
We actually got a question I was going to ask further down about this. It's Rhianne, I think it's how you pronounce it. She said, should my husband come to the first appointment, and should we already have had a semen analysis before we come for the first appointment with a fertility specialist?
I always encourage the partner, the male partner or female partner, the partner, you know, to come to the office visit. For a male partner, most of them have not had a semen analysis done, and we provide that service here. So they are able to, you know, submit a specimen, and we do analyze the sperm on the male partner. The infertility evaluation is always man and female, if that's the sort of makeup of the couple. So no, they don't need to have it beforehand. If they have had it, certainly bring it. But the majority of men have not had it done yet. So we will arrange for that.
It's always interesting to me, though. It seems like that because the doing a semen analysis is so less invasive and so much easier and so much less expensive, it just seems like that should be the very first step when a couple is knowing that they're struggling. I'm surprised in a way that it isn't, that it doesn't happen more often as the first step.
Right. I understand that. I hear you. You know, whenever we're approaching infertility, it's always evaluation of both partners, and we do it at the same time. So I would recommend that he have a semen analysis, and then we also at the same time start the evaluation on the patient. But I do agree it is less invasive. So, you know, I think probably part of the maybe the holdup also is that patients just don't know how to go about obtaining a semen analysis.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You know, it's not that it's not performed at every sort of lab center that you would visit, let's say, for a routine blood draw. So that might be some of the holds up, but we are very, you know, we're able to schedule it for the male partner, and it's done in a sort of very, again, efficient and sort of easy manner.
Is a physical exam usually a part of the first visit?
A physical exam is. It is typically part of the first visit. Not a full physical, but certainly I always check a thyroid. I always do a thyroid exam. Women that have infertility issues, and certainly women that have had irregular menstrual cycles, one of the things we always want to evaluate is the thyroid. So on exam, you want to see if the thyroid feels enlarged. And certainly if it does, it would then sort of trigger you to send thyroid testing. I always do an abdominal exam, you know, looking for scars from prior surgeries, and then certainly a pelvic exam. That is, you know, an internal exam, you know, feeling for the uterus, feeling to see if there's any sort of, you know, anything that is painful for the patient, to see what her cervix feels like. So it is, a physical exam is part of the first consult. And then taking it a step further, every new patient that I see, I do a pelvic ultrasound on to also look at the uterus and to look at, more specifically, at the ovaries.
What are you looking for with the pelvic ultrasound?
So in looking at the uterus, one, you want to see, make sure that it structurally looks normal, making sure that the size of the uterus is where it should be, that it's not enlarged. It's important to note if the patient has any presence of uterine fibroids. So uterine fibroids are a common finding for reproductive age women. You want to look and see if there's any evidence of a uterine anomaly. So a uterine anomaly would be sort of a different structure, a different, how can I explain this, a different progression of the development of the uterus actually from as you're developing as a fetus. I guess I'll say it that way.
But some, I mean, there's, we actually did a show a while, well, quite a while back on uterine abnormalities. And it was fascinating to me the different abnormalities that can be present. I mean, there can actually be that can be a septum dividing the uterus.
Correct.
Itself. It can also be the term that people often use is a tipped uterus. What does that mean?
Yeah, a tipped uterus essentially means typically people refer to a tipped uterus as medically the term is a retroverted uterus. So that just means a uterus that instead of either pointing straight back or slightly angled up, the uterus instead tips down. You know, that really is not a cause of infertility. It's just something to note on an exam or on an ultrasound. I often explain to patients it's almost like having a blue eye versus a brown eye or you know, a more common eye color. So that is called a retroverted uterus. It just means that the uterus itself tips downwards.
But doesn't necessarily impact your chances of conception.
It does not. It absolutely does not. No.
Okay, so unimportant thing.
Yeah, the rest of the ultrasound, importantly, so beyond the uterus, is that we do look at the ovaries. And so looking at the ovaries is very important. A lot of women, and certainly in New York City, are older in age. And one of our main concerns are, you know, is the presence of declining ovarian reserve. So meaning aging of the ovaries or aging eggs.
And can you tell that from a vaginal, a transvaginal ultrasound?
You can. I mean, we do the transvaginal ultrasound and we send specific blood markers and we look at the whole picture together.
Okay.
But by looking at the ovaries with an ultrasound, you can tell. You can tell if the ovaries are small in size, if they don't have a lot of potential eggs, and by that I mean looking for the presence of follicles. So the word follicle is a structure that you're able to see on the ultrasound that we presume has an egg inside of it. The more follicles, the better. Sometimes in women that have infertility, you know, I'll do an initial ultrasound at the initial consult, and I'll see the ovary looks small and there's only a few potential follicles. I'll, of course, wait for the blood test to come back, but necessarily I wouldn't be surprised if the blood results showed that the egg number was low. So you can, you know, gather a lot of information from a simple pelvic ultrasound.
Okay. And it's an easy test, you know, so from that standpoint, it's not particularly invasive, so it's a good beginning test.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between FSH and AMH, and how are they tested?
Okay. So they are both markers of ovarian reserve. FSH stands for follicle stimulating hormone. So just like we spoke about the follicles that I was looking for on the ultrasound, the FSH is actually a hormone that comes from the brain. So it's a hormone that comes from the pituitary gland in the brain, and it tells the ovary every month to ovulate an egg. It's almost like an egg food, you know, egg food, I'll call it. And so women that have declining ovarian reserve, let's say aging eggs or a low number of eggs, sometimes we will notice that there's an elevation of the FSH. And if there's an elevation from the FSH, it's because there's a signal that's coming from the ovary asking for more egg food, asking for more FSH, because the ovary is not doing what it should. So the FSH level is a blood test. It does have to be checked at the beginning of a menstrual cycle. So we like to check it somewhere on cycle day number 2 or cycle day number 3. And that I mean with their period. So the second or the third day of their full flow of their menses, of their period.
So you need to know that ahead of time before you schedule your first appointment. If an FSH test is going to be a part of it, if your cycle is predictable.
Right.
You need to predict it the best you can, predict your cycle and have the blood work then.
Right.
Is that part of your initial, when you're initially scheduling the first appointment, is that part of it that you ask when you're going to expect your period?
It's a fabulous idea. And when patients show up for me on their first appointment and I realize, they just started their menses, it actually is great. But I would say, honestly, the majority of patients schedule appointments when it is convenient for their, you know, work-wise or for their other scheduling issues that they have. So if the patient wants to be seen mid-cycle or at the end of their at the end of the cycle, let's say before they start a bleed, that's okay. We'll just have them come in for blood work with their follow-up bleed. So that's not an issue.
Okay.
We can see them for the initial consult, and then we'll schedule them for the blood work when they get their period.
Okay, so that's FSH, and that's a blood test. What is AMH, and how does it differ?
So FSH is the old gold standard. So it's the test that's been around for quite some time. It can vary month to month, although we always make note of the historical highest FSH level that we see. But it can vary month to month. The AMH levels, the AMH stands for anti-Müllerian hormone, and it's a newer marker. It's a less variable marker. And the beauty of the AMH is it can be sent at any time in the cycle. So it can be sent on cycle day 2 or 3, and it can be sent on cycle day 20. AMH is a hormone that is produced by the cells that surround the eggs themselves. And so it's almost opposite to the FSH as far as our interpretation. And I'll explain that. So younger women who have a lot of eggs have higher AMH levels. And let's say in this country, the average age of menopause is 50. The average AMH level for a 50-year-old is 0.0. So we see a gradual decline, let's say from age 25 to 50, of an AMH that starts at 4.0 and goes all the way down to 0.0. And most of us are somewhere in between. Most reproductive age patients are somewhere in between. So the AMH level gives us an idea of number of existing eggs that a patient has. And we do have age-specific averages. So I could tell a 34-year-old, your AMH is 1.2, and the average AMH for your age group is, 1.4. And so you're similar to other women your age. It might be the opposite. I might see a 34-year-old that has an AMH of 0.1, which would be more correlative to somebody in their late 40s. So it tells us really where the patient is and specifically where she is in comparison to women of her age.
And this is different from estrogen and other markers, say, of menopause. This is a separate test, and it's irrespective of the actual symptoms of cessation of menstruation.
Absolutely. Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And, you know, it's also a very nice predictive test for women who, let's say, need to go through fertility treatments. It gives us an idea of how much medication to give the patient. If she has a low AMH level, she can afford to take a nice hefty dose of medication. If she has a very high AMH level, which we see, let's say, in women who don't ovulate, women who have polycystic ovary syndrome, they have very high AMH levels. Those women, you get nervous. Could they make too many eggs in a fertility treatment? So those women, if they have a very high AMH, we give a low dose of medication. So it's actually a very nice test.
And I would assume that that's going to be done at your first appointment.
Yes.
Even more so than the FSH, because with FSH, that really depends on the timing of your first appointment. But the AMH, was that just a standard test that is going to be run?
Yes, it is. It's standard, and I send it on every patient on a new patient visit.
Okay. And I have read somewhere that AMH is not a particularly good predictor of ovarian reserves in older women or women with PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome. Is that true? And if so, why?
Right. I mean, I will say this. You know, women who have polycystic ovary syndrome, we know that they're going to have very high AMH levels. And, you know, I have seen women who have PCOS have AMH levels of 30. So I agree. It's not, you know, the test, it's, you know, the test is not, I should say, doesn't give correlative data between a level and pregnancy success. I guess that's the way I should describe it. So meaning a PCOS patient having an AMH of 30, does that make her sort of more successful at getting pregnant than a PCOS patient that has an AMH level of 10? No, it's not predictive in that manner.
And why do women, and I guess, I mean, is it because if you have polycystic ovaries, you are going to be having more cells that are going to be producing AMH, therefore your levels will be high? Is that why?
Yes. Okay, that makes sense. Yes, absolutely. So if you, and the same thing, if you did an ultrasound on a PCOS appearing, you know, or a patient with a diagnosis of PCOS or somebody that you suspect has PCOS and you do an ultrasound, you're going to see an enlarged ovary with many follicles, you know, 30, 40 follicles. So, you know, you send the AMH, but you know it will likely come back.
So why is AMH less predictive for older women?
You know, I don't know if that's necessarily true, to be honest. I mean, again, there's really no prediction between AMH levels and live birth. It's a very nice test to help us predict dose of medication. And secondly, oocyte or egg yield at the time of an egg retrieval if somebody was to go through IVF. So if somebody in an older patient and she had a low AMH, I mean, it's predictive of low egg yield. But again, there's definitely no correlative data between, you know, low AMH level and live birth. And in fact, you know, I've had some patients come to me, you know, who just, let's say, wanted a reproductive checkup. They're not infertile, but they just wanted a reproductive checkup. And this is something that we see a lot. And maybe their general gynecologist sent an AMH level on them, and they are 32 years old. And now their AMH level is low. You know, the patient comes in very worried. You know, she's not infertile. I would sort of talk to her about her options, but I would not worry her that she would not be able to have a live birth because of this low AMH level.
Would you encourage her to try to conceive, not continue to postpone conception, or depending upon her lifestyle, you know, where she is in her life or whatever, or that there's a risk associated, I guess is what you would probably
tell.
Right.
I mean, with any sort of declining ovarian reserve, we assume it gets worse with time. If I saw a 33-year-old with a low AMH that was just sent, and if she is in a relationship with somebody, I would encourage trying to conceive sooner rather than later. And then taking it a step further, if she does not have a partner, then we start the discussion of fertility preservation. And this is, you know, sort of a more recent, a hot topic.
It certainly is, yes.
But there are a lot of options for women available today that were not available some years ago. And certainly one of those is elective egg freezing or, you know, oocyte freezing. Certainly for women in their 30s who are not in serious relationships, or maybe they are and they're not ready to go down the road of trying to conceive. So, yes, I would encourage a conversation and go over options with the patient.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine you are seeing more patients come in for a fertility checkup in their early 30s. Just to find out, because now there is the option of doing something about it, where in the past there might have been an option, but it was more complicated.
Correct. Patients, like I said, patients, it's sort of the era of the reproductive checkup. Patients come in and just say, I want to know what my, you know, fertility potential is. And certainly if they're single, you know, elective egg freezing or oocyte freezing is something that a lot of patients are doing. So, you know, I would say two or so years ago, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine lifted a ban. They were labeling elective egg freezing as experimental.
Right.
Once that was lifted, some of the big companies that are out there, Google and Apple and Facebook, actually now pay for their female employees to have elective egg freezing.
Yeah, it's really been interesting how quickly that has
taken off. So, yes, this is something else as a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility physician that we, you know, deal with on a daily basis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You are listening to Creating a Family. Today we're talking about what to expect on your first visit to a fertility clinic. Creating a Family jumped in way back in 2007 into the social media because we knew that's where people were. And if, as an education and support nonprofit, if we wanted to educate and support, we had to be where the people are, and they were online. So we now have the largest social network in the world of infertility and adoption. There are three ways to connect with us on Facebook. You can like our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/creatingafamily. We also have a very large, very active Facebook support group. It is a group. It is a closed group. You can find it at facebook.com/groups/creatingafamily, all one word. Or you can connect with me personally, dawn.davenport1. We are found on Pinterest and Twitter as well. In fact, we really love Pinterest around here. We just added a new board over there. It's a fun place to hang out. And we are known as Creating a Family on both Pinterest and Twitter. So you can go over there. Please join us. It'd be more fun if you were there with us. Let me ask about some routine tests that may or may not be done at the very first appointment, but even if not on the first appointment, it would be on one of your earlier appointments. Is the Clomid challenge test still something that is fairly commonly used?
You know, it is not. You know, it's an old traditional test that used to exist, but has no role in sort of modern day infertility practices. I think probably because the AMH level has taken off, but we do we routinely do not do a Clomid challenge test. We don't.
Do most of the patients who come to see you, or let me ask that another way, have most of the patients that come to see you already been prescribed Clomid by their OBGYN?
I will say in New York City, no. I'm sure in other parts of the country, I'm sure the general OBGYN functions more so in that role. Occasionally I'll see a general OBGYN give Clomid out to a patient who, you know, has unexplained infertility, or actually I shouldn't say that, because to have the diagnosis of unexplained infertility, you would have to have the full evaluation. So maybe to somebody, let's say, who has polycystic ovary syndrome. But honestly, in New York City, typically if there's any, you know, concern for conceiving or infertility, they usually come straight to us. I'm sure in other parts of the country where fertility doctors are not as available, I'm sure that the general gynecologist does give it out much more frequent.
I think you're probably right on that exact, and for that exact reason.
Yeah.
I think you're probably right. What about a progesterone test that used to be a progesterone day 21 test? Is that gone the way of the dodo bird as well?
No, we actually send it. I will send it. And certainly in somebody who has irregular cycles and we don't know when the patient is ovulating, I will send a day 21 to 22 serum, you know, or blood test of progesterone. We don't send it for somebody that has regular cycles. If somebody gets a period every 28 to 30 to 31 days or 32 days, we know that they're ovulating. So we don't send it. I mean, the rationale of sending it is to help verify that the patient ovulated at least in that prior cycle. It does not give information about cycles that happened 3 months ago or 4 months ago, but it will give us information in that particular cycle if the patient ovulated.
And what are some of the tests that can be used to determine the fallopian tubes? Are they open? Are they functioning? Things like that.
Yes. So this is always a part of an initial consultation. We send blood work for ovarian reserve, like we discussed. We recommend and help schedule a semen analysis on the male partner, if it's a male-female couple. And then the third thing is fallopian tubes. So exactly as you said. That is traditionally done with basically the layman term is it's a fallopian tube x-ray or a hysterosalpingogram is the formal term. The nickname is called an HSG. And this is a test that is done actually very quickly. It is time dependent on the cycle. So it needs to be performed after the patient has her period, but before she would ovulate. So I typically tell patients somewhere between cycle day 6 and 13 that week. And the patient would go to a radiology facility, and essentially a speculum is placed, just like when the patient has a pap smear, and the radiologist will place a soft catheter into the cervix, contrast dye into the uterus. And as he is doing that, an x-ray machine comes over the patient and takes a picture. And the hope is that the dye travels up into the uterus and travels out of both of the fallopian tubes.
I have heard that that test is a fairly uncomfortable test. Is that something that you have seen in your practice as well?
I have, unfortunately. I always advise patients to expect cramping. I always advise patients that they should take 800 milligrams of Motrin or Advil 1 hour before the HSG. And the reason why the test is painful is as the contrast goes into the uterus, patients have cramping. So I do tell them that to expect. The good news is if the tubes are open, I would never subject, you know, tell the patient that she had to have it repeated again. So that's a good thing. But it can cause some cramping. Most patients, honestly, are tolerated fine. And once I tell them to take the Motrin, you know, they prepare the hour before. The other nice thing about that test, actually, is not only does it give information about the fallopian tubes, but it also gives information about the uterus. So inside of the uterus is the lining of the uterus where we expect an embryo, meaning a fertilized egg, to implant. And sometimes patients can have projections in the uterus that lead to an unsmooth surface, such as a fibroid, such as an endometrial polyp. So it's nice to make sure and to verify that the internal portion, you know, the internal contour of the uterus is smooth. So you can gather information about the internal contour of the uterus and the fallopian tube, patency is the word, opening of the fallopian tube.
And there's no way to determine this through a sonogram or a ultrasound, a transvaginal ultrasound. Is that correct?
Not for fallopian tubes. An ultrasound can, if there was a large fibroid or a polyp inside of the lining of the uterus, you can sometimes see it on a traditional 2D, you know, pelvic ultrasound. With the HSG, the advantage is that as the contrast is pushed into the uterus, it distends the walls of the uterus, and now you have this space that's filled with fluid. So you can't see that open space on a traditional sonogram. You cannot.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, again, if it was a large fibroid or a large polyp, you may be able to see that on a traditional sonogram.
Something that people have heard about, and again, this one may be an older test that's no longer used, but is a hysterosonogram to evaluate the uterus. Is that still something used, or has the HSG test supplanted that?
Absolutely. We do saline sonograms or hysterosonograms. The other term is saline infusion sonogram. They're all this. It's all the same, multiple different names for it. We do that test often. We do it for the same reasons that I mentioned. So let's say a patient already had an HSG, a hysterosalpingogram, performed last year, and our fallopian tubes are open, but now I see on a regular ultrasound something that looks like a polyp. Instead of making her go back and do the HSG, I'll just do the saline sonogram in the office because it's easier, it's much less painful. And so that test has a similar concept. Instead of instilling contrast, though, we instill saline. And as the saline is pushed into the uterus, again, the walls of the uterus distend, and using the regular transvaginal pelvic sonogram, I can then see if the patient truly has something in the uterine cavity like a polyp or a fibroid. We also do it prior to a patient undergoing IVF or in vitro fertilization. We always want to make sure that the cavity is smooth. We don't want to create embryos and then transfer them in to a cavity that could potentially have a polyp. That would be terrible. So we do it prior to an IVF cycle as well. And that test is not crampy at all. So that's why I know that the cramping is from the contrast. It's actually a test that's very easily, you know, well tolerated.
Yeah, that would make. I've not ever heard of anybody complaining about the saline.
Right.
I guess messiness is the only issue, and that's not painful. So.
Right.
You are listening to Creating a Family, and today we're talking about what to expect from your first visit at an infertility clinic. We are really glad to have you with us on the show. We primarily keep in touch with our audience through our weekly e-newsletters. We have two newsletters, one for infertility and one for adoption, and we let you know about the latest developments in infertility as well as the upcoming week's blog and show topics. It allows you to submit questions in advance for us to ask on air. You can sign up and receive our newsletter on any page of our website, creatingafamily.org. At what point do you start, or how do you test for endometriosis? And is that a routine part of one of your initial visits?
So endometriosis, if the patient, and actually I saw a patient yesterday who I diagnosed with endometriosis, just on an actual pelvic ultrasound. So if the patient has endometriosis that manifests or presents as having endometriosis in her ovaries, I will see it on an ultrasound. They appear very specific. So an endometrioma, you may have heard of the term chocolate cyst. This is an ovarian cyst that's filled with, really, if you were to open it, looks like chocolate. It's essentially old blood that's in the ovary. So those endometriomas can easily be seen on transvaginal ultrasound. If I do not see that on an ultrasound, I usually leave it at that. Back in the day, they would often do a laparoscopy, so meaning take the patient to an operating room and sort of look all over and see if they can find any endometriosis or endometriotic implants throughout her abdomen. And I believe that they used to do it for patients that had unexplained infertility. So meaning the ovaries looked fine, the tubes were open, the sperm was fine, and they didn't know what to do, so they would do laparoscopy and see if there was endometriosis. We don't do that anymore. We just don't. Our fertility treatments have come so far that it's much less risky to do a fertility treatment on a patient than put her under anesthesia, have incisions in the belly, and do a laparoscopy.
If I'm understanding you correctly, if you've got the symptoms of endometriosis, but let's say you can, and it's not so advanced, or it's advanced and it's not seen from a transvaginal ultrasound. Am I understanding you right, that the thought is, even if it's causing infertility, the treatment would be the same? You would be going through IVF. So rather than go through the invasiveness of figuring out and or trying to clean out the endometriosis itself, it's cheaper and less invasive to just do an IVF. Is that, am I following you right?
Yes, for the most part, with the exception, you know, if the patient has very large endometriomas, so large ovarian cysts that appear to be like endometriomas, we may opt to have those removed prior to IVF stimulation. So if it's a severe endometriosis that you see on sonogram with very enlarged cysts, I typically will tell the patient to have them removed, whether I do it or I send to a colleague that specializes in advanced gynecologic surgery. If it's minimal or, you know, endometriosis, or we're unsure if the patient has endometriosis, I would not recommend any sort of surgical investigation. I would say let's just move forward with a fertility treatment. But if it's severe and you see large endometriotic cysts, I typically would advise a patient to have them removed.
Or if they're coming to you, which they wouldn't be because you're a fertility doctor, but if they're coming to you for treatment of the symptoms, that's another issue. But in your case, they're coming to you because they're trying to get pregnant.
I mean, I do see some patients that come for endometriosis management that maybe aren't looking to conceive now, maybe in a year from now. So we, you know, part of being a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility doctor is that we do treat reproductive endocrine disorders, and certainly one of those is endometriosis. So I typically discuss medical management with the patient for endometriosis. If it was anything that required extensive surgery, then we would refer again to an advanced gynecologic surgeon. But for medical management, we actually handle that as well, even if they're not looking to conceive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So at what point will you discuss cost of treatment and go over options for payment and review insurance and things like that?
Right. And, you know, that's always such a hard part because not all patients have commercial insurance.
Most do not.
You know, not all patients with commercial insurance have coverage for fertility treatments. But RMA, you know, has an entire team that's dedicated to really insurance for the patients. So prior to the patient coming in, we have an idea of what their insurance will or won't pay for. And even on site. So if a patient comes to see me for an initial consult, they can find out that day what is covered under their insurance plan. If it's not covered, what the cost is to the patient. We always work with every single patient. We try to help as much as we can. You know, if there isn't coverage, there are a lot of organizations that may help cover. There are some pharmaceutical companies that may give discounted medications for patients. So there are a lot of different avenues that we can help the patient navigate if they don't have coverage.
Is that something that would be a part of a first appointment?
It can be. Yes, I mean, it absolutely can be. We have insurance counselors on site. Sometimes in the first visit, you don't know what the patient needs. You know, if a patient comes in and I have ordered, you know, ovary testing, fallopian tube testing, and semen testing, I may not know what the patient needs. So I may wait to, you know, have her meet with the insurance folks on the second follow-up visit. If the patient comes to me and we know that, let's say she had a tubal ligation 10 years ago, And now she's decided that she wants to have a baby. For that patient, I know she's going straight to IVF. She can absolutely meet with the insurance counselor that day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Same thing, you know, if they came with a semen analysis that was very abnormal. We may know that the patient is going to go and, you know, move forward with either IVF or an IUI, an insemination or an artificial insemination, so they can meet that day. But if we don't know, they can always meet, you know, at this follow-up visit or, you know, even over the phone, anything that makes it easier for them.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that this conversation has to be a part, because we think in terms of medical conditions, the treatment of medical conditions being covered by insurance, but it is the reality for many of our audience. So
yeah.
Like it or not, we have to discuss it. Yeah.
You know, for new, there are some states in the United States where fertility is sort of mandated coverage. Unfortunately, New York is not one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think Massachusetts might be.
They are. I think there's 13. There's somewhere in the neighborhood of 13.
Okay, so actually more than I thought.
Yeah, I'm not looking at my numbers right now, but it's somewhere in there.
Right.
Let me take a moment to thank a few more of our gold sponsors and remind you that it is through their generous support that we can bring you this show, as well as all the many resources we have at our website and on our videos and our YouTube channel and others. We have Manhattan Cryobank. They are dedicated to helping clients have healthy babies. By leveraging the technology of the of GenesPeak, it's a genetic testing company, Manhattan Cryobank is changing the way clients choose donor sperm and prioritizing the health of the client's future child. We also have the law offices of James Fletcher Thompson. They are a South Carolina firm committed to assisted reproductive law and adoption, including providing a gestational surrogacy matching program, as well as legal services for independent surrogacy, egg donation, and embryo donation as well. All right. What I'd like to do is leave our audience with some very practical advice of hints of what to do or tips of what to do on this to prepare for the first appointment and what they should bring with them. So let's just try to, and this is trying to be really kind of on a practical kind of mundane level. You've already mentioned any prior tests, bring the test results, any prior test results.
Yeah.
And that would probably be good to actually send ahead of time, so you've had a chance to look at them before the patient arrives. Okay, so any prior test results, obviously their insurance card, talk about mundane and boring. What else?
If they can bring their partner with them, certainly. If they have had any fertility treatments performed at other centers, so sometimes patients come to us for second opinions. Bring prior records from any office, really. And then I would really say, just don't be nervous. I think the biggest step really is sort of making the appointment and coming. I think that when patients are advised to make an appointment to see a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist, again, typically from their general, you know, gynecologist, it probably takes several months before they even make the appointment and come on in.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
But, you know, not to be nervous. That really, the first visit, it's a lot of talking. It's mostly talking. It's, you know, taking a thorough history, a medical history, a surgical history, family history on both partners, and really just sort of talking and getting to know each other and doing, you know, an exam and doing an ultrasound. So not to be nervous, to come in, to know that, you know, they're in a supportive environment, and, you know, taking that first step is the hardest, but once they do it, it's, you know, they'll sort of go through the process, you know, hopefully easy.
Mm-hmm. What about if, and quite frankly, most of our audience, before they have gone to see you, has been doing ovulation predicting kits or basal body temperature or cervical mucus, and many of them you know, have charts that they've created, or certainly some of them have even, you know, where they've taped all the test result kit, you know, the sticks onto pieces of paper and things like that.
Right.
Should they bring that information, and would that be something good for them to have tracked for a month or two before they come?
So if the ovulation predictor kits, I think, are certainly much easier and less time, you know, required than the basal body temperature. And honestly, most patients nowadays have the iPhone or, you know, some sort of smartphone and have apps. So most of my patients mm-hmm. come in with their apps, and they've had their cycles on there for 6 months, and I know exactly when they ovulated based on the onset of their period and or, you know, use of the ovulation predictor kits. So I always ask, the patients typically will show me their smartphone.
Yeah.
So that's where we've come.
Is there any, it's so true. Is there any particular app that you prefer over another one?
You know, I don't. I actually, that's a good question. I should look into that. No, nothing, not one particular app over another. But there are very nice apps where they give them, you know, certainly the length of the cycle over the past few months and, you know, mm-hmm. when they would have ovulated based on the app. And then, again, of course, if they've used the ovulation predictor kit, they can also insert that onto the calendar.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's as they say, there is definitely an app. There's so many to choose from.
Yeah. Yes.
As well. All right. So that people will bring their any prior test results for them or their partner, if it's a male partner, their partner. Should be coming as well.
Should be, yes.
And if they've got their ovulation results on their app or through their ovulation predicting kits or whatever, bring that. Relax, because if anything else, this is the first step in getting the problem solved. So, you know, pat yourself on the back and say, you know, making progress here.
Absolutely, absolutely. And always, you know, try and stay sort of focused on, you know, the prize, you know, at the end. You know, if they're persistent, things will happen. Things will happen.
Stay positive, yeah. As much as, and especially at this stage, this is a very positive step.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I think it's easier to feel positive and to stay positive at this point. So what type of questions should people be prepared to ask their doctor on this first visit or the first couple of visits?
So I think it's important for patients. I mean, obviously, this is after the evaluation is done, and we know the status of the ovaries. We know the status of the fallopian tubes and the uterus. We know the status of the sperm. I think what's most important is trying to figure out what are the options, what are the success rates, what are the risks and benefits of the medication options, you know, involved in these fertility treatments. And as much as the patient can stay informed about the options, you know, making a decision about sort of which road to go down. So ask lots of questions. No question is silly. I actually email with my patients. Patients email me all hours of the night questions, and if I'm awake, I'll answer it. And if not, I'll answer it the next morning. But really, no question is silly. They should know the success rates of everything, you know, that they're getting into, what's involved, what the time commitment is, again, what the risks and benefits of each option are.
And the financial commitment as well.
And the financial, absolutely. And that's like I said, that's why we have an entire devoted and separate department to help patients through that.
Because I got to tell you, I get overwhelmed even thinking about my insurance policy. And I think most people do. So I think that it's so helpful to talk with people who deal with insurance day in and day out as part of their job, because they can just help us walk through it and figure it out. It's just, I should add that creating a family has a number of resources to help you figure out your insurance and questions to ask and where to look in your policy. So we do provide resources, but I really think going to the specialist at your clinic makes such good sense, in addition to, you know, doing your own research, but it really makes sense to go to people who do with it day in and day out. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Excellent. So any last piece of advice that you would give people before coming in, and you're right, I think you're exactly right, that most people procrastinate making this appointment for any number of reasons. Most people know and have already been recommended to make an appointment to see a fertility specialist and have waited. So any piece of advice you would give people who are in that boat, who are hanging back and trying to decide or procrastinating?
Right. No, just that our goal is their goal. You know, our greatest achievement is discharging a patient who's pregnant, discharging the patient back to her obstetrician. So our goal is the same goal as the patient. And I don't know if that's true for every field of medicine, but it really is our goal. So just know that it's a team approach. Everybody's rooting for the patient. They want to see the patient through a successful treatment. And that really coming in and making that first appointment is, I think, the biggest hurdle. And that, you know, knowing that they are in a supportive environment, where they can ask as many questions as they want, and there's a lot of resource for the patient to help them achieve their goal of pregnancy and achieve their goal of creating a family. Exactly.
Well, on that wonderful note, I think that's a great place for us to stop. I'm going to tell our audience, if you have enjoyed our show and want to help us grow, do us a favor. Please rate this podcast on iTunes. The ratings, and we are the highest rated podcast by far in this entire area of talking about these subjects, and hence why we are listed on the What's Hot for Families Children on iTunes homepage. And it means a lot to us, these ratings do. So please jump on over to iTunes and give us a rating. If you've got iTunes on your phone, it's really easy to do. Just type in the words creating a family and we pop up and you can rate us there. Or you can just go to our website, creatingafamily.org/radio show. Click on the iTunes button and you can rate us there. It's either a star rating, or if you're really feeling magnanimous, you could give us a comment and that would be wonderful too. Thank you so much, Dr. Beth McAvee, for being our guest today on Creating a Family. If you want to participate in a discussion of the topics of this show, you can check out my blog tomorrow at creatingafamily.org/blog. I am sure some of you will want more information on Dr. McAvee or RMA New York. And if so, you can go to their website, which is rmany.com. I look forward to seeing you guys next week, where we will be discussing different topics relevant to the subjects of adoption and infertility.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive #1, #2 employee. Leave a message at the...
Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, this is pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.